It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists, they carefully monitor the trends of ocean warming and cooling. We learn about El Nino conditions and what blistering heat could mean for life here in Wisconsin. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff Boyne is a forecaster for the National Weather Service in La Crosse. Jeff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate.
Good morning. And Mark Brusberg is here, chief meteorologist for the Office of the Chief Economist in the World Agricultural Outlook Board in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mark, let's start with you. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, declares the official beginning of the El Nino weather pattern, and areas of the Pacific Ocean warmed up at least 0.9 degree Fahrenheit, higher than average. How is this rise in temperature different from daily temperature fluctuations?
Well, just looking at the Pacific Ocean, first of all, you have to understand that El Nino is part of this cycle where, for extended periods of times, the surface temperatures are above their expected normal. We just got out of several years of La Nina where it was below. So it's just a natural cycle. And the difference being, if you think of the atmosphere as being this, this heat engine, this heat transfer engine, basically what El Nino does when there's warmer than normal weather, it causes a deflection in normal weather patterns across the globe. And again, I'm already getting a little too technical, but basically what we do is we see wind shifts based on when we have an El Nino opposite what we have when we have a La Nina. So we do tend to see different types of weather across the world when it's one or the other.
Jeff, can you explain some of the ranges of changes to global weather and then closer to home here in Wisconsin, how it might affect our daily lives?
Well, what happens is, as the jet stream, what happens is you have the warmer than normal temperatures over the eastern and central part of the Pacific ends up resulting in changes in the jet stream. So you end up with more thunderstorm activity occurring in those central and eastern parts of the equatorial Pacific. That ends up with, and out in the western part of the Pacific, you end up seeing high pressure building up there. So it causes sinking air out there. This adjusts the jet stream, which eventually impacts part of the, around the globe as far as where the warm, abnormally warm weather and abnormally cold weather tends to occur, and also where places get wetter and other places get drier during El Nino. So, for example, from across the wintertime, pretty much going from like November to April, the southern U.S. becomes wetter than normal. It also becomes cooler than normal in the southeast United States. From the Ohio Valley up into the Great Lakes, you see more of a drier signal in the precip from December through March.
Drier, less precipitation in those winter months. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. Typically, you see more impacts during the winter seasons, during El Nino. You can occasionally see some start to develop in summer, and they'll continue in the fall. For example, here in Wisconsin, we tend to see cooler than normal conditions develop in the mid to late parts of summer, and then it will actually continue right on into fall. In the southern parts of Wisconsin, there is actually a drying signal for summer, but as we get into the latter parts of summer and into fall, that signal sort of vanishes. It disappears out of there as far as the climate signal for that. Now, as we head into winter, we tend to see warmer than normal temperatures for the state of Wisconsin, occasionally near. For example, since 1982-83, we've had like 13 El Ninos. Hmm. 8 of them have been in the warmest third, 4 of them have been in the near normal, and only one has been in the coldest third. So that means basically go ahead.
I was going to say, so you're really laying out the patterns here for us. And Mark, I want you to get at the why. Why is predicting an El Nino so important?
Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. One of the things that we've seen, again, is, you know, impacts globally. That global production impacts our producers and our food supply. I'll give you an example. We just had 3 years of La Nina that caused a significant drought in Argentina and other locations in South America. Well, they're competitors of ours for corn, soybeans, other major commodities. During an El Nino, we would expect a rebound in that, in conditions there. So people in South America, their farmers are very optimistic that they're going to have a very good growing season. Okay, that would ultimately impact our farmers' decisions because the peak of their growing season is in, you know, January, February. On the flip side of that, Australia is coming off of three bumper wheat crops. They're not expecting as good a wheat crop, even though conditions are okay now. You know, there's an expectation that there could be summer dryness. And again, their summer is our winter in Australia, but also in parts of Africa, which could cause a food shortage in some of the more needy locations. So what happens with the global food supply does ultimately come back to, you know, what our farmers are going to need. It helps USDA prepare, you know, if we're expecting, you know, during La Nina, you tend to get drought in the western United States. I mean, that helps local decision makers plan on how they're going to allocate water resources. If they think that there could be a dry season or a wet season. El Nino typically brings wetter weather over the winter, as was already pointed out, but that is their rainy season. So producers, water management, you know, agencies, private companies, they're keeping a close eye on what could happen during this El Nino. Again, it's part of a normal cycle. So we've seen many years, as Jeff pointed out, we've had many years of El Nino. We've had many years of La Nina. And, you know, that informs them on what to expect if mm-hmm. they do have the forecast for one or the other. So there's tremendous economic, impacts that, you know, we want to sort of get a gauge on.
Want to be prepared and gauge risk as well. Mark Brusberg, chief meteorologist at the USDA. Jeff Boyne here as well, forecaster for the National Weather Service office in La Crosse as we talk about El Nino conditions. And taking your questions, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Jeff, we spoke just recently to the president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, Kevin Krentz, and here is Kevin on how drought is affecting farmers in Wisconsin.
Normally, we get some dry weather in July and August, but this one is starting much earlier, by mid-May. Many of the crops are coming out of the ground very inconsistent because, depending where you are in the state, anything that was planted that mid-May on had to wait for rain to germinate because there just was not enough moisture in that top 3 inches of soil.
So, Jeff, is drought in Wisconsin connected to El Nino?
Typically, when you look at it, only across the southern third of the state that there is any significant signal that El Nino might be a little impact as far as drought goes. That seems to be the only spot across the state. Elsewhere across the state, when you look at it, it's highly variable as far as what precipitation you get during an El Nino.
you know, when you talk about, Jeff, these El Nino patterns happening again and again, do scientists gain a better understanding of the nuances of El Nino?
Yeah, I actually do. One thing sort of interesting about looking at the El Nino, and so El Nino Southern Oscillation is the entire thing. So it connects El Nino and La Nina together, these oscillations back and forth. They're not always consistent there. For example, if we go back to like La Nina, we've had them for the last 3 years. So looking back at that, we've actually seen some sort of a climate signal come into it where we're actually, when you consider La Nina, which is a better thing in summer, you tend to see more drought in summer. That's what we used to think. However, with the climate signal, we've been actually seeing wetter summers taking place. So actually in the southern part of Wisconsin, that dry signal that used to be always associated with La Nina is actually now becoming wetter. So we're actually seeing more wetter summers taking place. And we're seeing a shift now that we go to La Nina, we're starting to see more wetter summers taking place in La Nina. Meanwhile, in the northern part of the state, you still have some dryness continuing there. So it's only part of it. El Nino is only part of the thing that we look at. We also have to look at climate change and also other oscillations that take place around the world that also affect our climate.
Mark, what is the importance to you to looking at that long-term data?
Well, Jeff brings up a good point. I mean, we gain most of our knowledge of El Nino in the last, I'd say, since the 1980s. That's when some of the seminal research was done. And we have a record that, you know, anybody can go look at online going back to the 1950s. So it is important to recognize the, you know, some of the global patterns that can occur. But again, you know, we're entering into this new, I guess, phase of weather and climate where we're seeing warming. And in the case of a wetter climate like we see in the eastern United States, you know, we're seeing not only warmer conditions, but also more moisture in the atmosphere. So, you know, while it's important to recognize the pattern, we also have to keep in mind that, you know, things are changing and we're actually witnessing some areas getting wetter and some areas getting drier. So, again, it's sort of this never ending cycle of learning, adapting, and then trying to forecast, you know, what could happen, you know, 10 to 20 years out.
And we're going to get more deeply here into climate change. Mark Brusberg, Chief Meteorologist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Jeff Boyne with us, forecaster at the National Weather Service office in La Crosse, fielding your questions about the implications of El Nino weather patterns here in Wisconsin and globally. You can join in along the way. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine what could happen in an El Nino year and far-reaching changes that will affect Wisconsin and the world as the World Meteorological Organization declares the onset of these conditions. Call in with your question or comment about El Nino patterns, 800-642-1234. We have Jeff Boyne here, forecaster at the National Weather Service office in La Crosse, and Mark Brusberg, who's chief meteorologist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Let's bring on a call now, Jim in Sparta. Jim, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Doing well. What would you like to ask?
I'd like to ask, when I looked at the climate change website in Wisconsin on the university site, they talked about the data from 1950 to 2020. And if you actually went back, they removed that data now, but if you went back to 1900 or 1920 before the Dust Bowl, the average temperature in Wisconsin did not increase. And so I don't understand why they use such a small window. I also have data from my farm from my great-great-grandfather that shows weather data. And the farm has changed significantly over the years. It's had different periods of weather of where there was areas of the farm that were not farmable because of wetness, and then they dried out again. So I just think that if we're real truly scientists in this deal, we would be looking at a much broader time period. So I don't understand.
Jim, thank you. Gotcha. And I want to field that first to Mark. Go ahead. And then Jeff.
Okay. Yeah, it's, excuse me. We sort of, I mean, and again, thanks for the comment. We sort of have a debate amongst some of the people working in the climate science area as to what period of record is the best to look at. I work very closely with the Drought Monitor, and there's now some research being undertaken to actually look at trying to view drought in a shorter time frame rather than a long time frame. Because as you noted, things are different than they were in the 1930s and the 1950s. But also there's new sources of information that have a shorter time period. Like there's not as big a history for soil moisture. Some of the modeled products, like when we look at atmospheric dryness, evapotranspiration, and things like that, satellite products, we don't have a long time period. So we're trying to use some of the newer technology to assess how severe drought is and how it matches up with other historical droughts. So it's very confusing. There is a school where the more data, the merrier, 100 years plus. But then there's this other, segment of people doing the research saying, no, we really should look at some of the shorter term periods of record. So it is, depending on who you ask, you're going to get a different opinion on that.
And Jeff, your insights here on assessing climate change and the window to look at.
As far as what Mark was bringing up, he brought a very good point. One thing we are noticing, looking at some of the data, is we're seeing more rapid transitions because of it becoming wetter. We're seeing more rapid transitions from drought to being normally wet back to drought. We're seeing these quicker transitions. For example, like we just came out of the wettest winter for the state of Wisconsin. Those records go back into the 1895. So we just came back with the wettest winter on record for the state. And then all of a sudden, we've now just went into a very dry period. Matter of fact, up through looking at the growing season for Madison, we're looking at one of the top five driest growing seasons right now to date in the Madison area. So we can see these rapid transitions taking place. As far as Jim's comment about temperatures going on in the state of Wisconsin, I just pulled up looking at some of the records go back to 1895. It was much cooler during the prior to 1950. Yeah, there were some warm years back in the 1930s that were much warmer than normal, but it was a much cooler period there. Looking back since like the late 1990s, 7 out of the 10 warmest years in the state of Wisconsin have occurred since the late 90s. So we've had a very warm time period here. So we've been seeing this warming taking place in the last 3 to 4 decades or so.
Circling back to El Nino, is then El Nino have some linkages to human activity and the result of fossil fuels?
Typically, we're seeing more. It's not really linked to it that much as far as what's going on with them. As Mark brought up, it is a natural cycle between El Nino and La Nina. These do oscillate back and forth with each other. So we do see a natural oscillation that does take place. Now, the impacts from El Nino and La Nina can change as the planet continues to warm. So these impacts we can change, just as I brought up earlier, talking about how the summer precipitation in La Nina is actually changing now. So that's just an example of how things change. Another example, for example, La Nina winters prior to the 1980s were much cooler. That way we could guarantee that we probably heading into La Nina, we would see a colder than normal winter. Now that signal is sort of gone now. It's, if you looked at the three categories above, below and near, they're pretty much almost equal now. So that signal of cold has sort of vanished.
Jeff Boyne, forecaster at the National Weather Service in La Crosse, and Mark Brusberg, chief meteorologist at the USDA, as we talk about El Nino conditions. 800-642-1234 to join in. Mark, you know, we've seen these large wildfires in Canada and California polluting air quality across the world. Can El Nino conditions impact more wildfires, cause more wildfires?
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I don't do the research in that area, but I just read a study that was published from NCAR, which is NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Research. And they were looking at how the wildfires in Australia several years ago impacted or possibly made worse the La Nina that we just got out of. So that's being looked at. It's quite possible that, you know, the smoke is having an impact similar to what we've seen with major volcanic eruptions, where it could be impacting that. So like I said, I don't personally
Fresh research there. Yes.
Right. It is an interesting topic, and people are seeing linkages between things like wildfire and volcanic activity with the normal cycle of ENSO.
Mark and Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Mark, thanks for having us.
Mark Brusberg, chief meteorologist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Jeff Boyne, forecaster at the National Weather Service. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.